Fear none. It was early in the afternoon when they arrived at the location Ari had designated, a gentle curve in the Rama River that marked its farthest excursion eastward. Aragorn strained to look over Saphira's neck as he searched for a glimpse of anyone below. The land appeared empty, save for a herd of wild oxen. When the animals caught sight of Saphira, they fled, lowing and kicking up plumes of dust. They and a few other smaller animals, scattered about the countryside, were the only living creatures Aragorn could sense. Disappointed, he shifted his gaze to the horizon, but saw no sign of Arya. Saphira landed on a slight rise, 50 yards from the banks of the river. She sat, and Aragorn sat with her, resting his back against her side. On the top of the rise was an outcropping of soft, slate-like rock. While they waited, Aragorn amused himself by grinding a thumb-sized flake into the shape of an arrowhead. The stone was too soft for the arrowhead to be anything other than decorative, but he enjoyed the challenge. When he was satisfied with the simple triangular point, he set it aside and began to grind a larger piece into a leaf-bladed dagger, similar to those the elves carried. They did not have to wait as long as he first thought. An hour after their arrival, Saphira lifted her head from the ground and peered across the plains in the direction of the not-so-distant Haderach Desert. Her body stiffened against his, and he felt a strange emotion within her, a sense of impending momentousness.
"Look,"
she said. Keeping hold of his half-finished dagger, he clambered to his feet and peered eastward. He saw nothing but grass, dirt, and a few lone, windswept trees between them and the horizon. He broadened his area of scrutiny, but still saw nothing of interest. "What?" he started to ask, then cut himself off as he looked up. High in the eastern sky, he saw a wink of green fire like an emerald glimmering in the sun. The point of light arced through the blue mantle of the heavens, approaching at a rapid pace, bright as a star at night. Aragorn dropped the stone dagger, and without taking his eyes off the glittering spark, climbed onto Saphira's back and strapped his legs into her saddle. He wanted to ask her what she thought the point of light was, to force her to put into words what he suspected, but he could not bring himself to speak any more than she could. Saphira held her position, although she unfolded her wings, and keeping them bent nearly in half, lifted them in preparation to take off. As it grew larger, the spark proliferated, dividing into a cluster of dozens, then hundreds, then thousands of tiny points of light. After a few minutes, the true shape of it became visible, and they saw that it was a dragon. Saphira could wait no longer. She uttered a resonant trumpet, leaped off the rise, and flapped downward. Aragorn clutched the next spike in front of him as she ascended at a nearly vertical angle, desperate to intercept the other dragon as quickly as possible. Both he and she alternated between elation and a wariness born of too many battles. In their caution, it pleased them that they had the sun to their backs. Saphira continued to climb until she was slightly above the green dragon, whereupon she leveled off and concentrated upon speed. Closer, Aragorn saw that the dragon, while well-built, still had some of the gangly look of youth. His limbs had yet to acquire the stocky weight of gladers or thorns, and he was smaller than Saphira. The scales upon his sides and back were a dark forest green, while those upon his belly and the pads of his feet were lighter, with the smallest ones verging upon white. When against his body, his wings were the colour of holly leaves, but when the light shone through them, they were the colour of oak leaves in the spring. At the juncture between the dragon's neck and back was a saddle, much like Saphira's. And on the saddle sat a figure that looked to be Arya, her dark hair streaming from her head. The sight filled Aragorn's heart with joy, and the emptiness he had laboured under for so long vanished like the darkness of night before the rising sun. As the dragons swooped past each other, Saphira roared, and the other dragon roared in response. They turned and began to circle as if chasing each other's tails, Saphira still slightly above the green dragon, who made no attempt to climb above her. If he had, Aragorn would have feared he was attempting to gain the advantage before attacking. He grinned and shouted into the wind. Arya shouted back and raised an arm. Then Aragorn touched her mind just to be sure, and he knew in an instant that it really was Arya, and that she and the dragon meant them no harm. He withdrew a moment later, for it would have been rude to prolong the mental contact without her consent. She would answer his questions when they spoke on the ground. Saphira and the green dragon roared again, and the green dragon lashed his whip-like tail. Then they chased each other through the air until they reached the Rama River. There Saphira took the lead and spiraled down until she landed upon the same rise where she and Aragorn had been waiting. The green dragon landed 100 feet away, settling into a low crouch while Arya freed herself from her saddle. Aragorn tore the straps off his legs and jumped to the ground, banging the sheath of Brisinger against his leg. He ran over to Arya and she to him, and they met in the middle between the two dragons, who followed at a more sedate pace, their steps weighing heavily on the ground. As he drew near, Aragorn saw that in place of the leather strip that Arya usually wore to keep her hair back, a circlet of gold rested upon her brow. In the center of the circlet, a teardrop-shaped diamond flashed, with light that came not from the sun, but from within its own depths. At her waist hung a green-hilted sword in a green sheath, which he recognized as Tamerlane, the same sword the Elf Lord Fiola had offered him as a replacement for Zarok, and that had once belonged to the rider Arva. However, the hilt looked different than he remembered, lighter and more graceful, and the sheath appeared narrower. It took Aragorn a moment to realize what the diadem meant. He looked at Arya with astonishment. "You?" "Me," she said, and inclined her head. "Atra esterni ono Thelduin, Aragorn. Atra du Evarinio ono Varda, Arya Drotning?" It did not escape him that she had chosen to greet him first.
"Drotning," she confirmed. "My people chose to give me my mother's title, and I chose to accept."
Above them, Saphira and the green dragon brought their heads close together and sniffed one another. Saphira was taller. The green dragon had to stretch his neck to reach her. As much as Aragorn wanted to talk with Arya, he could not help staring at the green dragon.
"And him?"
he asked, motioning upward. Arya smiled. And then she surprised him by taking his hand and leading him forward. The green dragon snorted and lowered his head until it hung just above them, smoke and steam rising from the depths of his crimson nostrils.
"Aragorn," she said, and she placed his hand on the dragon's warm snout. "This is Fearnan. Fearnan, this is Aragorn."
Aragorn looked up into one of Fearnan's brilliant eyes. The bands of muscle within the dragon's iris were the pale green and yellow of new blades of grass.
"I am glad to meet you, Aragorn friend Shadeslayer,"
said Fearnan. His mental voice was deeper than Aragorn expected, deeper even than that of Thorn or Glaedah or any of the Eldunari from Rohengard.
"My rider has told me much about you."
And the dragon blinked once, with a small, sharp sound, like a shell bouncing against a stone. In Fearnan's wide, sunlit mind, planked as it was with transparent shadows, Aragorn could feel the dragon's excitement. Wonder swept through Aragorn, wonder that such a thing had come to pass.
"I am glad to meet you as well, Fearnan Finearel. I never thought that I would live to see you hatched and free of Galbatorix's spells."
The emerald dragon snorted softly. He looked proud and full of energy, like a stag in fall. Then he returned his gaze to Saphira. Between the two of them, much passed. Through Saphira, Aragorn could feel the flow of thoughts, emotions, and sensations, slow at first, but then swelling into a torrent. Arya smiled slightly.
"They seem to have taken to each other."
"That they have." A mutual understanding guiding them, he and Arya walked out from under Saphira and Fearnan, leaving the dragons to themselves. Saphira did not sit as she normally did, but remained crouched as if she were about to spring onto a deer. Fiernan did the same. The tips of their tails twitched. Arya looked well, better, Aragorn thought, than she had since their time together in Ellesmere. For a lack of a more suitable word, he would have said she looked happy. Neither of them spoke for a while as they watched the dragons. Then Arya turned toward him and said, "I apologize for not contacting you sooner. You must think badly of me for ignoring you and Saphira for so long, and for keeping such a secret as Fiernan." "Did you receive my letter?"
"I did."
To his surprise, she reached inside the front of her tunic and removed a square of battered parchment that after a few seconds he recognized.
"I would have answered, but Fiernan had already hatched, and I did not want to lie to you, even by omission."
"Why keep him hidden?"
"With so many of Galbatorix's servants still on the loose, and so few dragons remaining, I did not want to risk anyone finding out about Fiernan until he was large enough to defend himself."
"Did you really think a human could have snuck into Duweldenvarden and killed him?"
"Stranger things have happened. With the dragons yet on the brink of extinction, it was not a risk worth taking. If I could, I would keep Fiernan in Duweldenvarden for the next 10 years, until he is so large that none would dare attack him. But he wished to leave, and I could not deny him. Besides, the time has come for me to meet with Nasawada and Oryk in my new role."
Aragorn could feel Fiernan showing and telling Saphira about the first time he caught a deer in the Elves' Forest. He knew that Arya was aware of the exchange as well, for he saw her lip twitch in response to an image of Fiernan hopping in pursuit of a startled doe after he tripped over a branch.
"And how long have you been queen?" "Since a month after my return. Vanna doesn't know, however. I ordered the information kept from him and our ambassador to the dwarves, so that I could concentrate on raising Fiernan without having to worry about the affairs of state that otherwise would have fallen to me. You might like to know, I raised him on the crags of Telnair, where Oromis lived with Gleda. It seemed only right."
Silence fell between them. Then Aragorn gestured at Arya's diadem and at Fiernan and said,
"How did all of this happen?"
She smiled.
"On our return to Ellesmere, I noticed that Fiernan was beginning to stir within his shell, but I thought nothing of it, as Saphira had often done the same. However, once we reached Duweldenvarden and passed through its wards, he hatched. It was nearly evening, and I was carrying his egg in my lap, as I used to carry Saphira's, and I was speaking to him, telling him of the world, and reassuring him that he was safe. And then I felt the egg shake, and—"
She shivered and tossed her hair, a bright film of tears in her eyes.
"The bond is everything I imagined it to be. When we touched, I always wanted to be a dragon rider, Aragorn, so that I could protect my people and avenge my father's death at the hands of Galbatorix and the Forsworn. But until I saw the first crack appear in Fiernan's egg, I never allowed myself to believe that it might actually come to pass."
"When you touched, did—"
"Yes."
She lifted her left hand and showed him the silvery mark on the palm, the same as his own, Gedwe Ignazia.
"It felt like—"
She paused, searching for the words.
"Like ice-cold water that tingled and snapped," he suggested. "Exactly like that."
Without seeming to notice, she crossed her arms as if chilled.
"So you returned to Ellesmere,"
said Aragorn. Now Saphira was telling Fiernan about when she and Aragorn swam in Leona Lake while travelling to Dras Leona with Brom.
"So we returned to Ellesmere."
"And you went to live on the crags of Telnir.
But why become queen when you were already a rider?" "It was not my idea. Daethader and the other elders of our race came to the house on the crags, and they asked me to take up my mother's mantle. I refused, but they returned the next day, and the day after that, and every day for a week. and each time with new arguments for why I should accept the crown. In the end, they convinced me that it would be best for our people.
Why you, though? Was it because you are Islanzadi's daughter? Or was it because you had become a rider?
It was not just because Islanzadi was my mother, although that was part of it. Nor was it just because I was a rider. Our politics are far more complicated than those of the humans or the dwarves, and choosing a new monarch is never easy. It involves obtaining consent from dozens of houses and families, as well as several of the older members of our race, and every choice they make is part of a subtle game that we have been playing amongst ourselves for thousands of years. There were many reasons why they wanted me to become queen, not all of them obvious.
Aragorn shifted, glancing between Saphira and Arya, unable to reconcile himself to Arya's decision.
How can you be a rider as well as a queen? He asked. The riders aren't supposed to support any one race above the others. It would be impossible for the other peoples of Alagazia to trust us if we did. And how can you help rebuild our order and raise the next generation of dragons if you're busy with your responsibilities in Ellesmira?
The world is not as it used to be, she said. Nor can the riders remain apart as they once did. There are too few of us to stand alone, and it will be a long while before there are again enough of us to resume our former place. In any event, you have already sworn yourself to Nasawada and to Oryk and Dorgrim Stingitum, but not to us, not to the Aelfakin. It is only right that we should have a rider and dragon as well.
You know that Saphira and I would fight for the elves as much as for the dwarves or the humans, he protested.
I know, but others do not. Appearances matter, Aragorn. You cannot change the fact that you have given your word to Nasawada and that you owe your loyalty to Oryk's clan. My people have suffered greatly over the past 100 years, and though it may not be apparent to you, we are not what we once were. As the fortunes of the dragons have declined, so too have our own. Fewer children have been born to us, and our strength has waned. Also, some have said that our minds are no longer as sharp as they used to be, although it is difficult to prove, one way or another.
The same is true of humans, or so Gleda told us, said Aragorn.
She nodded. He is right. Both of our races will take time to recover, and much will depend upon the return of the dragons. Moreover, even as Nasawada is needed to help guide the recovery of your race, so too do my own people need a leader. With Islanzadi dead, I felt obliged to take the task upon myself.
She touched her left shoulder, where her tattoo of the Yahweh glyph lay hidden.
I pledged myself to the service of my people when I was not much older than you. I cannot abandon them now, when their need is so great.
They will always have need of you.
And I will always answer their call, she replied. Do not worry. Fionn and I shall not ignore our duties as a dragon and rider. We will help you to patrol the land and settle what disputes we can, and wherever it seems best to raise the dragons, we shall visit and lend our assistance as often as we can, even if it be at the far southern end of the spine.
Her words troubled Aragorn, but he did his best to hide it. What she promised would not be possible if he and Saphira did as they had decided during the flight there. Although everything Arya had said helped confirm that the path they had chosen was the right one, he worried that it was a path that Arya and Fionn would be unable to follow. He bowed his head then, accepting Arya's decision to become queen, and her right to make it.
I know you won't neglect your responsibilities, he said. You never do.
He did not mean the statement unkindly. It was merely a statement of fact, and one for which he respected her.
And I understand why you did not contact us for so long. I probably would have done the same in your place.
She smiled again.
Thank you.
He motioned toward her sword. I take it Runan reworked Tamerlane to better fit you.
She did, and she grumbled about it the whole while. She said the blade was perfect the way it was. But I am well pleased with the changes she made. The sword balances as it should in my hand now, and it feels no heavier than a switch.
As they stood watching the dragons, Aragorn tried to think of a way to tell Arya of their plans. Before he could, she said,
"You and Saphira have been well?"
"We have."
"What else of interest has occurred since you wrote?"
Aragorn thought for a minute, then told her in brief about the attempts on Nasawada's life, the uprisings in the north and the south, the birth of Roran and Katrina's daughter, Roran's ennoblement, and the list of treasures they had recovered from within the citadel. Lastly, he told her of their return to Carverhall and their visit to Brom's final resting place. While he spoke, Saphira and Fearnan began to circle each other, the tips of their tails whipping back and forth faster than ever. They both had their jaws slightly open, baring their long white teeth, and they were breathing thickly through their mouths and uttering low, whining grunts, the likes of which Aragorn had never heard before. It looked almost as if they were going to attack each other, which worried him. But the feeling from Saphira was not one of anger or fear. It was...
"I want to test him," said Saphira.
She slapped her tail against the ground, causing Fearnan to pause.
"Test him? How? For what?"
"To find out if he has the iron in his bones and the fire in his belly to match me."
"Are you sure?"
he asked, understanding her intent. She again slapped her tail against the ground, and he felt her certainty and the strength of her desire.
"I know everything about him. Everything but this. Besides,"
she displayed a flash of amusement,
"it's not as if dragons mate for life."
"Very well, but be careful."
He had barely finished speaking when Saphira lunged forward and bit Fearnan on his left flank, drawing blood and causing Fearnan to snarl and spring backward. The green dragon growled, appearing uncertain of himself, and retreated before Saphira as she prowled toward him.
"Saphira!"
Chagrined, Aragorn turned to Arya, intending to apologize. Arya did not seem upset. To Fearnan, and to Aragorn as well, she said,
"If you want her to respect you, then you have to bite her in return."
She raised an eyebrow at Aragorn, and he responded with a wry smile, understanding. Fearnan glanced at Arya and hesitated. He jumped back as Saphira snapped at him again. Then he roared and lifted his wings as if to make himself appear larger, and he charged Saphira and nipped her on a hind leg, sinking his teeth into her hide. The pain Saphira felt was not pain. Saphira and Fearnan resumed circling, growling and yowling with increasing volume. Then Fearnan jumped at her again. He landed on Saphira's neck and bore her head to the ground, where he held her pinned and gave her a pair of playful bites at the base of her skull. Saphira did not struggle as fiercely as Aragorn would have expected, and he guessed that she had allowed Fearnan to catch her, as it was not something even Thorn had managed to do. "The courting of dragons is no gentle affair," he said to Arya.
"Did you expect soft words and tender caresses?"
"I suppose not." With a heave of her neck, Saphira threw Fearnan off and scrambled backward. She roared and clawed at the ground with her forefeet, and then Fearnan lifted his head toward the sky and loosed a rippling pennant of green fire twice the length of his own body.
"Oh!"
exclaimed Arya, sounding delighted.
"What? That's the first time he has breathed fire."
Saphira released a blast of fire herself. Aragorn could feel the heat from over 50 feet away. And then she crouched and jumped into the sky, climbing straight upward. Fearnan followed an instant later. Aragorn stood with Arya as they watched the glittering dragons ascend into the heavens, spiraling around each other with flames streaming from their mouths. It was an awe-inspiring sight, savage and beautiful and frightening. Aragorn realized he was watching an ancient and elemental ritual, one that was part of the very fabric of nature itself, and without which the land would wither and die. His connection with Saphira grew tenuous as the distance between them increased, but he could still sense the heat of her passion, which darkened the edges of her vision and blotted out all thoughts save those driven by the instinctual need that all creatures, even the elves, are subject to. The dragons shrank until at last they were no more than a pair of sparkling stars orbiting each other in the immensity of the sky. As far away as they were, Eragon still received a few flashes of thoughts and feelings from Sephira, and though he had experienced many such moments with the Eldunari when they had shared their memories with him, his cheeks grew hot, as did the tips of his ears, and he found himself unable to look directly at Arya. She too seemed affected by the dragon's emotions, although differently than he. She stared after Sephira and Fearnan with a faint smile, and her eyes shone brighter than usual, as if the sight of the two dragons filled her with pride and happiness. Eragon let out a sigh, and then squatted and began to draw in the dirt with a stalk of grass. "Well, that didn't take long," he said.
"No," said Arya.
They remained that way for a number of minutes, she standing, he squatting, and all silence around them, save for the sound of the lonely wind. At last, Eragon dared look up at Arya. She looked more beautiful than ever. But more than that, he saw his friend and ally. He saw the woman who had helped save him from Durza, who had fought alongside him against countless enemies, who had been imprisoned with him under Dras Leona, and who in the end had killed Shrukan with the Dauthdert. He remembered what she had told him about her life in Ellesmere when she was growing up, her difficult relationship with her mother, and the many reasons that had driven her to leave Duweldenvarden and serve as an ambassador to the elves. He thought, too, of the hurts she had suffered, some from her mother, others from the isolation she had experienced among the humans and the dwarves, and still more when she had lost Faelin and then endured Durza's tortures in Gilead. All those things he thought of, and he felt a deep sense of connection with her, and a sadness, too. And a sudden desire came upon him to capture what he saw. While Arya meditated upon the sky, Eragon looked about until he found a piece of the slate-like rock projecting from the earth. Making as little noise as possible, he dug out a slab with his fingers and brushed off the dirt until the stone was clean. It took him a moment to remember the spells he had once used, and then to modify them so as to extract the colours needed from the earth around him. Speaking the words silently, he incanted the spell. A stir of motion, like a swirl of muddy water, disturbed the surface of the tablet. Then colours, red, blue, green, yellow, bloomed on the slate, and began to form lines and shapes, even as they intermingled to form other, subtler shades. After a few seconds, an image of Arya appeared. Once it was complete, he released the spell and studied the Faerth. He was pleased with what he saw. The image seemed to be a true and honest representation of Arya, unlike the Faerth he had made of her in Ellesmere. The one he held now had a depth that the other one had lacked. It was not a perfect image with regard to its composition, but he was proud that he had been able to capture so much of her character. In that one image, he had managed to sum up everything he knew about her, both the dark and the light. He allowed himself to enjoy his sense of accomplishment for a moment more, then he threw the tablet off to the side to break it against the ground.
"Kauster,"
said Arya, and the tablet curved through the air and landed in her hand. Eragon opened his mouth, intending to explain or to apologize, but then he thought better of it and said nothing. Holding up the Faerth, Arya stared at it with an intent gaze. Eragon watched her closely, wondering how she would react. A long, tense minute passed. Then Arya lowered the Faerth. Eragon stood and held out his hand for the tablet, but she made no move to return it. She appeared troubled, and his heart sank. The Faerth had upset her. Looking him straight in the eye, she said in the ancient language,
"Eragon, if you are willing, I would like to tell you my true name." Her offer left him dumbstruck. He nodded, overwhelmed, and with great difficulty managed to say, "I would be honored to hear it."
Arya stepped forward and placed her lips close to his ear, and in a barely audible whisper, she told him her name. As she spoke, the name rang within his mind, and with it came a rush of understanding. Some of the name he knew already, but there were many parts that surprised him, parts that he realized must have been difficult for Arya to share. Then Arya stepped back and waited for his response, her expression studiously blank. Her name raised numerous questions for Aragorn, but he knew that it was not the time to ask them. Rather, he needed to reassure Arya that he did not think any less highly of her because of what he had learned. Nor did he. If anything, her name had increased his regard, for it had shown him the true extent of her selflessness and her devotion to duty. He knew that if he reacted badly to her name, or even said the wrong thing without intending to, he could destroy their friendship. He met Arya's gaze full on, and said, also in the ancient language, Your name is a good name. You should be proud of what you are. Thank you for sharing it with me. I am glad to call you my friend, and I promise that I will always keep your name safe. Will you now hear mine? She nodded. I will, and I promise to remember and protect it for so long as it remains yours. A sense of import came over Aragorn. He knew there was no going back from what he was about to do, which he found both frightening and exhilarating. He moved forward and did as Arya had done, placing his lips by her ear and whispering his name as softly as he could. His whole being vibrated in recognition of the words. He backed away, suddenly apprehensive. How would she judge him, fair or foul? For judge him she would. She could not help it. Arya released a long breath and looked at the sky for a while. When she turned to him again, her expression was softer than before. You have a good name as well, Aragorn, she said in a low voice. However, I do not think it is the name you had when you left Palancar Valley. No, nor do I think it is the name you bore during your time in Ellesmere. You have grown much since we first met. I've had to, she nodded. You are still young, but you are no longer a child. No, that I am not. More than ever, Aragorn felt drawn to her. The exchange of names had formed a bond between them, but of what sort he was unsure, and his uncertainty left him with a sense of vulnerability. She had seen him with all his flaws, and she had not recoiled, but had accepted him as he was, even as he accepted her. Moreover, she had seen in his name the depth of his feelings for her, and that too had not driven her away. He debated whether to say anything on the subject, but he could not let it go. After gathering up his courage, he said, Arya, what is to become of us? She hesitated, but he could see that his meaning was clear to her. Choosing her words with care, she said, I don't know. Once, as you know, I would have said nothing, but again, you are still young, and humans often change their minds. In 10 years or even 5, you may no longer feel as you now do. My feelings won't change, he said with utter certainty. She searched his face for a long, tense while. Then he saw a change in her eyes, and she said, If they don't, then perhaps in time. She put her hand on the side of his jaw. You cannot ask more of me now. I do not want to make a mistake with you, Aragorn. You are too important for that, both to me and to the whole of Alagaesia. He tried to smile, but it came out more as a grimace. But we don't have time, he said. His voice choked. He felt sick to his stomach. Arya's brow furrowed, and she lowered her hand. What do you mean? He stared at the ground, trying to think how to tell her, In the end, he just said it as simply as he could. He explained the difficulty he and Saphira had had in finding a safe place for the eggs and the Eldunari. And then he explained Nasiwada's plan to form a group of magicians to keep watch over every human spellcaster. He spent several minutes talking, and concluded by saying, "So Saphira and I have decided that the only thing we can do is leave Alagazia and raise the dragons elsewhere, far away from other people. It's what's best for us, for the dragons, for the riders, and all the other races of Alagazia."
"But the Eldunari," said Arya, appearing shocked.
"The Eldunari can't stay either. They would never be safe, not even in Ellesmira. As long as they remain in this land, there will be those who will try to steal them or use them to further their own designs. No, we need a place like Vroengard, a place where no one can find the dragons to hurt them, and where the younglings and the wild dragons cannot hurt anyone themselves."
Aragorn tried to smile again, but gave it up as hopeless. "That is why I said we have no time. Saphira and I intend to leave as soon as we can. And if you stay, I do not know if we will ever see each other again."
Arya glanced down at the faerth she still held, troubled.
"Would you give up your crown to come with us?" he asked, already knowing the answer.
She lifted her gaze. "Would you give up charge of the eggs?" He shook his head. "No." For a time, they were silent, listening to the wind.
"How would you find candidates for the riders?" she asked.
"We'll leave a few eggs behind, with you, I suppose. And once they hatch, they and their riders will come join us, and we'll send you more eggs."
"There must be another solution, besides you and Saphira and every Eldunari abandoning Alagazia. If there were, we would take it, but there isn't. What of the Eldunari? What of Gleda and Umaroth? Have you spoken to them of this? Do they agree?"
"We haven't spoken to them, but they will agree. That I know."
"Are you sure about this, Aragorn? Is it really the only way? To leave behind everything and everyone you have ever known?"
"It's necessary, and our departure was always meant to be. Angela foretold it when she cast my fortune in Tirm, and I've had time to accustom myself to the idea."
He reached out and touched Arya on the cheek.
"So, I ask again, will you come with us?"
A film of tears appeared on her eyes, and she hugged the faerth against her chest.
"I cannot."
He nodded and took his hand away.
"Then we will part ways."
Tears welled in his own eyes, and he struggled to retain his composure.
"But not yet," she whispered. "We still have some time together. You will not leave immediately."
"No, not immediately."
And they stood next to each other, gazing into the sky and waiting for Saphira and Fearnan to return. After a while, her hand touched his, and he grasped it. And though it was a small comfort, it helped dull the ache in his heart.
A Man of Conscience. Warm light streamed through the windows along the right of the hallway, illuminating patches of the far wall, where banners, paintings, shields, swords, and the heads of various stags hung between the dark, carved doors that dotted the wall at regular intervals. As Aragorn strode toward Nasiwada's study, he gazed out the windows at the city. From the courtyard, he could still hear the bards and musicians performing by the banquet tables laid out in Arya's honour. The celebrations had been ongoing since she and Fearnan had returned to Illyria with him and Saphira the previous day. But now they were beginning to wind down, and as a result, he had finally been able to arrange a meeting with Nasiwada. He nodded to the guards outside the study, then let himself into the room. Inside, he saw Nasiwada reclined on a padded seat, listening to a musician strumming on a lute and singing a beautiful, if mournful, love song. On the end of the seat
sat the witch-child Elva, engrossed with a piece of embroidery, and in a nearby chair, Nasawada's handmaid Ferica. And curled up on Ferica's lap lay the weercat Yellow-Eyes in his animal form. He looked sound asleep, but Aragorn knew from experience that he was probably awake. Aragorn waited by the door until the musician finished.
"Thank you. You may go," said Nasawada to the player. "Ah, Aragorn, welcome."
He bowed slightly to her. Then to the girl he said, "Elva?" She eyed him from under her brow.
"Aragorn?"
The weercat's tail twitched.
"What is it you wish to discuss?"
asked Nasawada. She took a sip from a chalice resting on a side table.
"Perhaps we could speak in private," said Aragorn,
and motioned with his head toward the glass-paneled doors behind her, which opened onto a balcony overlooking a quadrangle with a garden and fountain. Nasawada considered for a moment, then rose from her seat and swept toward the balcony, the train of her purple dress trailing behind her. Aragorn followed, and they stood side by side, gazing at the spouting water of the fountain, cool and grey within the shadow cast by the side of the building.
"What a beautiful afternoon," said Nasawada as she took a deep breath.
She looked more at peace than when he had last seen her, only a few hours before. "The music seems to have put you in a good mood," he observed.
"No, not the music. Elva."
He cocked his head.
"How so?"
A strange half-smile graced Nasawada's face.
"After my imprisonment in Urubain, after what I endured and lost, and after the attempts on my life, the world seemed to lose all colour for me. I did not feel myself, and nothing I did could stir me from my sadness."
"I thought as much," he said,
"but I did not know what to do or say that might help." "Nothing, nothing you could have said or done would have helped. I might have gone on like that for years, if not for Elva. She told me what I needed to hear, I suppose. It was the fulfillment of a promise she made me long ago, in the castle at Aberon."
Aragorn frowned and glanced back into the room, where Elva sat poking at her embroidery. For all they had gone through together, he still did not feel as if he could trust the girl, and he feared that she was manipulating Nasawada for her own selfish ends. Nasawada's hand touched his arm.
"You don't need to worry about me, Aragorn. I know myself too well for her to unbalance me, even if she tried. Galbatorix couldn't break me. Do you think she could?"
He looked back at her, his expression grim. "Yes." She smiled again.
"I appreciate your concern, but in this it's unfounded. Let me enjoy my good mood. You can put your suspicions to me at a later time."
"All right." Then he relented a bit and said, "I'm glad you're feeling better."
"Thank you. As am I. Are Saphira and Fearnan still cavorting about as they were earlier? I don't hear them anymore."
"They are, but they're above the overhang now." His cheeks warmed somewhat as he touched Saphira's mind.
"Ah."
Nasawada placed her hands, one atop the other, upon the stone balustrade, the uprights of which were carved into the shape of flowering irises.
"Now, why did you wish to meet? Have you arrived at a decision with regard to my offer?"
"I have."
"Excellent. Then we may proceed apace with our plans. I've decided not to accept."
"What?" Nasawada looked at him with incredulity.
"Why? To whom else would you entrust the position?"
"I don't know," he said gently. "That's something you and Orin will have to figure out on your own." Her eyebrows rose.
"You won't even help us choose the right person? And you expect me to believe that you would not follow orders from anyone but me?"
"You misunderstand," he said. "I don't want to lead the magicians, and I won't be joining them either." Nasawada stared at him for a moment. Then she walked over and closed the glass-paneled doors to the balcony, so that Elva, Ferica, and the weercat could not overhear their conversation. Turning back to him, she said,
Aragorn, what are you thinking? You know you have to join. All of the magicians who serve me have to. There can't be any exceptions, not one. I can't have people think that I'm playing favorites. It would sow dissent among the ranks of the magicians, and that is exactly what I don't want. As long as you are a subject of my realm, you have to abide by its laws, or my authority means nothing. I shouldn't have to tell you that, Aragorn.
You don't. I'm well aware of it. Which is why Sephira and I have decided to leave Alagazia.
Nasawada put her hand on the railing, as if to steady herself. For a time, the splashing of the water below was the only sound.
I don't understand.
So once more, as he had with Arya, he set forth the reasons why the dragons, and therefore he and Sephira, could not stay in Alagazia. And when he finished, he said,
It never would have worked for me to take charge of the magicians. Sephira and I have to raise the dragons and train the riders, and that must take precedence before all else. Even if I had the time, I couldn't lead the riders and still answer to you. The other races would never stand for it. Despite Arya's choice to become queen, the riders have to remain as impartial as possible. If we start to play favorites, it will destroy Alagazia. The only way I would consider accepting the position would be if the magicians were to include those of every race, even the Urgals. But that's not likely to happen. Besides, it would still leave the question of what to do about the eggs and the Eldunari.
Nasawada scowled.
You can't expect me to believe that with all your power, you can't protect the dragons here in Alagazia. Maybe I could, but we cannot depend on magic alone to safeguard the dragons. We need physical barriers. We need walls and moats and cliffs too high for man, elf, dwarf or Urgal to scale. More important, we need the safety that only distance can provide. We have to make it so difficult to reach us that the challenges of the journey will discourage even our most determined enemies from attempting it. But ignore that. Assuming that I could protect the dragons, the problem would still remain of how to keep them from hunting livestock, ours as well as the dwarves and Urgals. Do you want to have to explain to Oryk why his flocks of Feldunos keep disappearing? Or do you want to have to keep appeasing angry farmers who have lost their animals?
No, leaving is the only solution.
Aragorn looked down at the fountain.
Even if there were a place for the eggs and the Eldunari in Alagazia, it wouldn't be right for me to stay.
Why is that?
He shook his head.
You know the answer as well as I. I've become too powerful. As long as I'm here, your authority and that of Arya, Oryk and Orin will always be in doubt. If I asked them to, most everyone in Sirda, Tirm and your own kingdom would follow me. And with the Eldunari to help me, there is no one who can stand against me, not even Murtagh or Arya. You would never turn against us. That's not who you are.
No?
In all the years I shall live, and I might live a very long time, do you honestly believe that I will never choose to interfere with the workings of the land? If you do, I'm sure it will be for a good reason, and I'm sure we will be grateful for your help.
Would you?
No doubt I would believe my reasons were just, but that's the trap, isn't it? The belief that I know better, and that because I have this power at my disposal, I have a responsibility to act.
Remembering her words from before, he echoed them back to her.
For the good of the many. If I was wrong, though, who could stop me? I could end up becoming Galbatorix despite my best intentions. As it is, my power makes people tend to agree with me. I've seen it in my dealings throughout the Empire. If you were in my position, would you be able to resist the temptation to meddle just a little in order to make things better? My presence here unbalances things, Nasawada. If I am to avoid becoming what I hate, then I have to leave.
Nasawada lifted her chin.
I could order you to stay. I hope you don't. I would prefer to leave in friendship, not anger. So you will answer to no one but yourself? I will answer to Sephira and to my conscience, as I always have.
The edge of Nasuada's lip curled.
A man of conscience, the most dangerous kind in the world.
Once more, the sounds of the fountain filled the gap in their conversation. Then Nasuada said,
Do you believe in the gods, Aragorn?
Which gods? There are many.
Any of them, all of them. Do you believe in a power higher than yourself?
Other than Sephira? He smiled an apology as Nasuada frowned. Sorry. He thought seriously for a minute, then said,
Perhaps they exist? I don't know. I'm not sure what I saw, but I may have seen the dwarf god Guntera in Trondheim when Auric was crowned. But if there are gods, I don't think very highly of them for leaving Galvatorix on the throne for so long. Perhaps you were the god's instrument for removing him. Did you ever consider that?
Me? He laughed. I suppose it could be, but either way, they certainly don't care very much whether we live or die.
Of course not. Why should they? They are gods. Do you worship any of them, though? The question seemed of particular importance to Nasuada.
Again, Aragorn thought for a while. Then he shrugged.
There are so many. How could I know which ones to choose? Why not the creator of them all, Unalakuna, who offers life everlasting?
Aragorn could not help but chuckle.
As long as I don't fall sick and no one kills me, I may live for 1,000 years or more. And if I live that long, I can't imagine I would want to continue on after death. What else can a god offer me? With the Eldunari, I have the strength to do most anything. The gods also provide the chance to see those we love again. Don't you want that?
He hesitated.
I do. But I don't want to endure for an eternity. That seems even more frightening than someday passing into the void, as the elves believe.
Nasuada appeared troubled.
So you do not hold yourself accountable to anyone other than Sephira and yourself? Nasuada, am I a bad person?
She shook her head.
Then trust me to do what I believe is right. I hold myself accountable to Sephira and the Eldunari and all of the riders who are yet to be, and also to you and Arya and Auric and everyone else in Alagazia. I need no master to punish me in order to behave as I ought. If I did, I would be no more than a child who obeys his father's rules only because he fears the whip and not because he actually means good.
She gazed at him for several seconds.
Very well, then. I will trust you.
The splashing of the fountain once more achieved prominence. Overhead, the light from the sinking sun picked out cracks and flaws in the underside of the stone shelf.
What if we need your help?
She asked.
Then I'll help. I won't abandon you, Nasuada. I'll bind one of the mirrors in your study with a mirror of my own, so that you will always be able to reach me. And I'll do the same for Roran and Katrina. If trouble arises, I'll find a way to send assistance. I may not be able to come myself, but I will help.
She nodded.
I know you will.
Then she sighed, unhappiness plain on her face.
What?
He asked.
It was all going so well. Galbatorix is dead. The last of the fighting has settled down. We were going to finally solve the problem of the magicians. You and Sephira were going to lead them and the riders. And now, I don't know what we'll do. It'll sort out, I'm sure. You'll find a way. It would be easier with you here. Will you at least agree to teach the name of the ancient language to whomever we choose to lead the magicians?
Aragorn did not have to think about it, since he had already considered the possibility. But he paused while he tried to find the right words.
I could, but in time, I think we would come to regret it.
So you won't? He shook his head. Frustration crossed her face.
And why not? What are your reasons now? The name is too dangerous to bandy about lightly, Nessawada. If a magician full of ambition but lacking scruples got hold of it, he or she could wreak an incredible amount of havoc. With it, they could destroy the ancient language. Not even Galbatorix was mad enough to do that, but an untrained, power-hungry magician? Who knows what might happen? Right now, Arya, Murtagh, and the dragons are the only ones besides me who know the name. Better to leave it at that. And when you go, we will be dependent upon Arya, should we have need of it. You know she will always help. If anything, I would worry about Murtagh. Nessawada seemed to turn inward. You needn't. He's no threat to us. Not now. As you say, if your goal is to keep the spellcasters in check, then the name of the ancient language is one piece of information that is better to withhold. If that is truly the case, then I understand. Thank you. There's something else you should know as well. Masawada's expression grew wary. Oh? He told her then about the idea that had recently occurred to him concerning the Urgles. When he finished, Nessawada was quiet for a while. Then she said, "You take much upon yourself." "I have to. No one else can. Do you approve? It seems the only way to ensure peace in the long run. Are you sure it's wise?" "Well, not entirely, but I think we have to try." "The dwarves as well? Is that really necessary?" "Yes. It's only right, it's only fair. And it will help maintain the balance among the races." "What if they don't agree?" "I'm sure they will." "Then do as you see fit. You don't need my approval, you've made that clear enough. But I agree that it seems necessary. Otherwise, 20, 30 years from now, we may be facing many of the problems our ancestors faced when they first arrived in Alagazia." He bowed his head slightly. "I'll make the arrangements." "When do you plan on leaving?" "When Arya does." "So soon? There's no reason to wait longer." Nessawada leaned against the railing, her eyes fixed on the fountain below. "Will you return to visit?" "I'll try, but I don't think so. When Angela cast my fortune, she said I would never return." "Ah." Nasawada's voice sounded thick, as if she were hoarse. She turned and faced him directly. "I'm going to miss you." "I'll miss you too." She pressed her lips together, as if struggling not to cry. Then she stepped forward and embraced him. He hugged her back, and they stood like that for several seconds. They parted then, and he said, "Nessawada, if you ever tire of being queen, or you want a place to live in peace, come join us. You'll always be welcome in our hall. I cannot make you immortal, but I could prolong your years far beyond what most humans enjoy, and they would be spent in good health." "Thank you. I appreciate the offer, and I won't forget it." However, he had a feeling that she would never be able to bring herself to leave Alagazia, no matter how old she was. Her sense of duty was too strong. Then he asked, "Will you give us your blessing?" "Of course." She took his head between her hands, kissed him upon his brow, and said, "My blessings upon you and Saphira. May peace and good fortune be with you, wherever you go." "And with you," he said. She kept her hands upon him for another moment. Then she released him, and he opened the glass door and exited through her study, leaving her standing alone upon the balcony.